watches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, or WZKW Kingsville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week we continue our twice a month class series by economist Doug Dowd, based on his as yet unpublished recent book, The USA, Where We Are and Where We Are Headed. This week he addresses the indexes for quality of life in America: income, security, education, and housing. But we're going to begin our show with a story centered here in Ithaca that deals with quality of life issues as well. The environment we live in, and who has the power and who does not, to make decisions about how the physical space in our communities is used. The interest of the commons frequently comes into contact with individual property rights, but it is not as simple as a public-private dichotomy. The Supreme Court recently ruled that government entities may exercise eminent domain, that is, the taking of private land of individuals, not only on behalf of public works, but now also on behalf of private corporate interests in the name of economic development. In plain language, the city council can force you to sell out to Walmart. In other words, corporate profits above all. I dare say that most people in America are not even aware of this recent decision, but that if they were, right or left, Democrats, Republicans, and everybody else would be overwhelmingly outraged. I know since this was reported on Democracy Now! A few days ago, many people have mentioned it to me. Expressions of disgust have been universal. This spring, a long simmering controversy between the public good and corporate desires reached a crisis point in Ithaca. At stake is the fate of the Redbud Woods, a 2-acre green space located on University Avenue at the edge of the Cornell campus. The university, which holds title to the land, wants to make it a parking lot. The city of Ithaca has spent years in unsuccessful court proceedings trying to save the woods. The Ithaca Common Council declared the woods an historic district in 2001. It is part of the estate of Robert Treeman, who was responsible for the protection of much of the area's natural beauty. Now a coalition has formed of Ithaca residents, Cornell students, faculty, staff, and more than 500 Cornell alumni who are determined to save the woods. Some have even put their bodies in the way of chainsaws. I went to the Redbud Woods and spoke with 5 of those defenders about their actions to save the Redbud Woods and the larger context of the controversy, democracy, accountability, and sustainability, and the dilemma of a small city with a mammoth university in its midst. This is Nora, a Cornell student who has been organizing to save the woods.
It's such a small space. There's been so much debate about its value for different purposes for different people, but at the bottom line, it's really a beautiful green space that has, its value has been demonstrated by all the people that have been here for so long and put in so much energy for it. Anybody who's been down here in May when the red buds have been in bloom will tell you that they just blow you away. They're really, really beautiful. And at the end of the day, whatever Cornell needs to get done can get done without a parking lot here. That's really what does it for me. This doesn't have to happen.
Anna, an Ithaca resident.
When I first heard about this, the impending danger of the parking lot, I thought it was just a really silly place to make into a parking lot. It's not really even close to the buildings that they had planned the parking lot for. And also, it's such a beautiful space. I think that sometimes people lose sight of how important green spaces are in urban areas. And that's one of the things that makes Ithaca special, is that there are many green spaces, but they're rapidly decreasing. It keeps people happy. It keeps people from feeling distressed to have trees and to have all these green spaces.
Nora.
The parking lot plan is part of a much larger construction project for West Campus of Cornell, revamping a whole lot of the older dorms and creating a new atmosphere on West Campus. They had the opportunity to provide for parking within that plan. There were a couple of different options in the planning phase, and then those were ultimately scrapped with the understanding that parking would be found elsewhere, and so that's how Redbud Woods came into play.
Josh, a local sustainability activist.
The parking lot has kind of been in the works for even longer, like maybe even going back 10 years. So the main issue is that Cornell didn't really consult with the city or the residents of the neighborhood about the parking lot, and they're just kind of in a bureaucratic process that to them seems unstoppable. In March, basically, the decision was handed down from the state's appellate court, which is the highest court in New York, that basically said this is Cornell's private property, they can do whatever they want. And that was in March, and that's when direct action started on the part of student organizers. Nora locked down to a tree in front of Day Hall.
Day Hall houses all of the major administration buildings for the university, including the president's office.
What was the response from the officials at Cornell?
The response from Cornell? They really want to sweep this under the rug as much as possible. We were really expecting a huge response from them and got almost nothing. It was really surprising.
Since there was no response, the two people locked in front of Day Hall. Eight people went into Day Hall, and several of them locked down in the president's office, hoping to get an interview or a meeting with the president. And they were arrested, even though they were being nonviolent and just being passive resistors. The police, I guess it could be said that they used excessive force to remove some of the students. They would have been carted off to the Ithaca Police Department for booking, but a large group outside sat down in the driveway blocking the police's exit, so they had to book the students in the basement of Day Hall and then release them.
Anna.
When we started the actual sit-in, so to speak, in the woods, it was about 2.5 weeks ago.
Right after graduation, we knew that they were going to come as soon as the students were gone. They were going to come and do the work then.
Yeah, we had been preparing. We had this sort of warning that they could come anytime. They showed up shortly after.
How did you prepare for this?
Well, we have tree sits in several of the trees. We put up the platforms, and there's a person staying in them to protect the tree and that area around it. Like, on a broader note, we all took nonviolence trainings to prepare ourselves for the situations we'd be facing so that we could really stick to our nonviolence pledge, and had call lists and called the media.
Everybody was trained in climbing and safety as well. The last thing we want is people to get hurt. And also, I guess the nonviolence training can help with that as well, in case police are called in. But we also are prepared for pain compliance, a.k.a. torture, pepper spray, maybe even gas or something, for the police to use to get us out of the tree sits.
Nora.
The Monday morning after graduation, was it? It was about 2 weeks ago, three weeks ago. Some workers came in with chainsaws around 8 in the morning and just started raising through quickly as they could, and we all rushed down and called our phone list and got everyone here really quickly, and we all just stood in the woods. That was really effective in saving a lot of the trees they didn't try to move us. They hadn't put up any kind of fence or anything to keep anyone out. They did fell trees right around us and very close proximity to people. But we stood our ground and they had to leave.
I mean, this is hearsay, but I heard one woman say that one of the workers waved a chainsaw in front of her face and said, well, if you're so tough, why don't you stand under this tree while I cut it down on top of you?
Yeah, they were being very aggressive.
Who were these people? What company was it?
Economy Paving, based out of Cortland.
We had one of the members of our group up in a tree at the time to prevent that tree from being cut down, and they definitely were making statements like, we'll cut that tree down with him in it, being very aggressive towards us.
Nora and I forget who else were locked down kind of about 100 feet into the woods, and they had cleared pretty much up to that point, and then they fell the tree within 5 feet of where these two were locked down. And
you were in a tree right then, weren't you?
Yeah, I was in a tree further into the woods, so all I could hear was the chainsaws, and I could see the trees dropping, but I didn't know what was going on because everybody was over there to try to stop it. So at that time, it was very, very frightening because all I could see was the trees dropping.
I know the one that was, like, felled towards people was probably about 8 to 10 inch diameter. It was probably, like, a 30-year-old tree or something. But at that point, the guy that was up in the tree set, Cyrix, took throw balls and attached them to ropes and threw them into three trees around where he was sitting in his tree, and then tied nooses at the ends of the ropes and put them around his neck so they couldn't cut any of those trees down or continue cutting in that direction at all. That was kind of a spur-of-the-moment thing that we later decided, when everything cooled down, wasn't such a good idea, but it did serve the desired effect and stop cutting. And then after that, a storm came up, a really bad storm, lightning and hail and heavy winds, and that kind of forced a halt to the work for the day, but the tree sitters and ground support and people in lockdown all stayed throughout the storm and weathered it out.
Nora.
After we had had a confrontation with Economy Paving, with us being in the woods and trees being felled around us, the police arrived. Things sort of quieted down after that a little bit. They had to stop cutting, but that was only after things had already happened in the woods.
At one point, the Cornell police came in and said that we had a warning to leave. Anyone who stayed would be charged with trespass, after they put up a yellow police line tape around the woods.
Grace, Ithaca resident.
And so at first a bunch of people did leave, but then it was pretty clear that they didn't have the number to arrest people, and so a lot of people went back into the woods, and of course the people who were locked down didn't leave.
Josh.
After that original incident, Cornell's insurance company got a lot of complaints. So the insurance company, I think, kind of swung some weight and told Cornell that they couldn't continue their project until they dealt with it in a safe manner by putting up a fence, which they haven't done yet.
Construction has stopped for the moment, but the fate of the woods still hangs in the balance. Grace.
Well, we were having meetings, sort of negotiations with them for a while, or talking about possible options for Cornell to follow in reducing cars on campus and that sort of thing. And those talks have sort of stopped for now, but we haven't really gotten a final answer from them. So we're waiting on that, for one thing.
Are you saying that Cornell was reconsidering its intention to turn this area into a parking lot?
Not exactly. But maybe, that's our hope. At this point, we asked them, well, all along we've asked them for a moratorium for at least 3 months to review other options and talk about alternatives to this parking area. That is what they're mulling over right now.
The president of the university, Jeffrey Lehman, resigned. It was during alumni weekend, which was like a week and a half ago, and But our theory is that the university is just kind of in such disarray. He's already packed up and left, and the interim president, Hunter Rawlings, who was a former president of the university, hasn't really arrived on the scene yet. Actually, Rawlings was the one who kind of set this parking lot in motion, so it's kind of fitting that he has to come back and clean up his mess. So we're just kind of waiting.
So in terms of this, the negotiations that were going on regarding an alternative plan, what kind of alternative plans were discussed?
We've been giving them suggestions all along.
Great.
I mean, way before the negotiations started. People from the community have been giving suggestions. We've had thousands of ideas here. Generally, we were just talking about how to incorporate more democracy and sustainability and community relations at Cornell University.
This campaign has really become the poster child for a lot of much larger campaigns.
Nora.
Within Cornell, specifically with respect to sustainability, democracy, and community. President Lehman launched on what he called an institutional commitment to sustainability this past year, which is ironic given the situation. It's really been a springboard for a lot of debate about sustainability in the campus as a whole. Sort of the idea that this is where it starts. It starts right here on campus with these decisions that are made. Parking, especially cars, it's a huge issue for sustainability. And then also democratic processes within the university and a sense of community with Ithaca.
Josh.
The path of power isn't really all that clear. It seems like maybe this was decided by, like, the transportation department, and then, like, because the bureaucratic process is just so, like, you know, there's just so many layers to it, there's just no way to, like, clearly define who has the ultimate say. And right now, like, we don't even know who's in charge anymore.
One thing that we've really been talking about a lot is the issue of transparency for decisions that are made within Cornell, especially really big decisions like this one that affect a lot of people and that a lot of people are really strongly invested in. It's been a great opportunity for the community at large to talk about these things, but we haven't had a great response from the university as of yet.
I feel like it's a parallel to many of the power problems in this world, that Cornell can sit on the hill and dictate what happens and that affects the whole community.
Grace.
Since I've lived in Ithaca, there's been Lake Source Cooling and multiple projects that Cornell has undertaken that the Ithaca community has rallied against, and they never listen to us, and they don't care if it impacts the community negatively, if it advances their own goals, no matter what those are. Part of the reason I'm involved is to have some kind of accountability in the future for Cornell, so that, yeah, legally this land is theirs, legally they can pave it, but they should care what the rest of the community thinks.
In the grand scheme of things, the redbud woods are really insignificant. Hundreds and, you know, possibly even thousands of redbud woods get cut down every day just because of economic forces that are beyond any one person's control. You know, it's just systematic. I'm a permaculture designer, and I was trained to think about problems holistically. From a sustainability standpoint, that means using stuff from your bioregion to build stuff in your bioregion, cutting down on needless waste like fossil fuels, and designing in such a way that you are serving multiple functions and creating a more diverse and more robust system in the process. Everything economically is pushing towards a suicidal system. You know, once you destroy the web of life, and paving in particular is the most destructive thing to the ecology of the planet, once you destroy that, you can never get it back. And it's destroyed not like in huge swaths all at once in clear cuts, although that does happen. It gets destroyed like one piece at a time. I think just because of who we're in conflict with, Cornell University, and because of the creativity and inspiration and knowledge that lives in this town, I think as a designer, I've also been taught to look for leverage points in the system. And this is one of those leverage points where we can defend these woods, we can stop these woods from getting cut down, but also we can raise the issues related to sustainability and transportation, and eventually turn Cornell around and put this brilliant institution and this beautiful creative town at work on the issues. And instead of being in conflict, we could work together with the university and come up with some really brilliant solutions to all these problems and demonstrate them right here.
Proposed lot is only for 176 cars, which is just laughable, really, that they would go through something like this for such a small gain. You know, there's no question that 176 spots is, it's not going to solve the parking problem that Cornell has. They need to step back and take a much bigger and more sustainable approach to transportation around
here. The Redbud Woods defenders will remain on the scene indefinitely, and they hope to create widespread dialogue and action on an array of important issues facing the community.
We'd all like to invite people to come up to the woods and just check it out, see what's going on, see what we're doing, stand out by the road, you know, talk to us, come hang out for 15 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, whatever. Just come and get to know the woods.
And the more we each, as individuals, educate ourselves about sustainability and about growing your own food and about consuming less and driving less and working less, the more time and energy and ideas we'll have to help save the planet, because ultimately this is really the battle for our time, is figuring out how to live on the planet, really reverse all the damage that we've done, because time's running out.
Julian, you're up in a tree sit. How long have you been there? What's up?
I come up and down on and off, but I've probably spent a total of 10 nights in the tree and a lot of time during the day. So, a large amount of time by now.
How far up are you?
What's that?
How far up is that? How many feet in the air?
I think around 50 feet.
Uh-huh. Are you scared of heights?
Not really. I had some fears to work through when I first got up here, but it feels really normal and natural now, so it was, I don't know, it's very healing in that way to confront those things and realize that I'm safe up here and just, like, be able to enjoy myself without worrying. Yeah, I can see the sunset from here, too, on the lake.
Were you up in this tree when they came with the chainsaws?
Yep.
What was that like?
They kind of ignored me up here for a while because they're more worried about what was going on over there. So I got to see a lot of stuff. I was woken up to having a tree go down. And I ended up coming down in the storm, which was really scary, but it worked out well. I don't know. I feel like after that experience, I'm a lot closer, and like now nothing really scares me up here after being up there during all that. So I don't know. I'm glad I was here during that. It was a growing experience.
What would you like to say to people about what's going on here?
It's for me, it's symbolic of a lot of larger issues, specifically about the way people interact with their natural environment. And I feel like it brings up a lot of issues that are underlying but aren't usually talked about. And, I mean, for me, it's just... the trees in the woods and any woods have inherent right to be just on their own. And they're alive, and you can enter into relationships with them. And I really appreciated seeing the ways that we've transformed through being here in the woods, and seeing the ways the woods have transformed with our presence, in terms of putting up the art and drawing the group together. And it's like our human community and this non-human community are very linked together, and it's a really beautiful thing to see that so tied, because I think most of the time we're really disconnected.
To learn more and to get involved, visit www.redbudwoods.org. Redbudwoods.org.
Well, paper cups are fun and plastic forks are cool. I like to be on the move when I eat my gruel. Don't get me wrong, disposable diapers are really great. But my favorite feature of these United States are parking lots and strip malls. Thank you.
strip malls, the ocean tide, parking lots and strip malls, parking lots and strip malls. The world needs more parking lots and strip malls. Well, I love to see those factories making useful stuff, and I go to the Cineplex when life is getting rough.
Rovick singing Parking Lots and Strip Malls. Next, we continue our popular education series with economist Doug Dowd. What you're going to hear is the fifth session of a free public course which meets every 2 weeks in San Francisco. Doug Dowd is the author of many books and a veteran of many struggles, who has taught at universities coast to coast, including Cornell, where he was chair of the economics department during the 1960s. Now 85, he continues to write and share his knowledge with students of all ages in California and Italy, where he lives part of each year. Doug Dowd.
As some of you know, in my Berkeley class, there's a couple that's been coming to the classes for years. I once told a story about flags, and she made a T-shirt with this expression that I'm going to give to you, which she sells for $10, I don't think she has any more. This is years ago. In 1967, I think it was, there was a big anti-war meeting at the University of Michigan at their football stadium where there are 40,000 seats, and I was one of the speakers. In fact, I was the first speaker, and I got up and there were 40,000 people there against the war in Vietnam. And the very first thing I said was, "Piss on all flags!" And everybody stood up and cheered, you know. So there's this T-shirt which says, "Piss on all flags," stuck down. And it's, in some sense or another, I've become either immoral or immortal. I don't know which it is, or both. So let's go on with the game. This is the second part of our discussion of social policy, human and social needs. Last time it was all about health care, and this time I want to, as much as I can, talk about Social Security and education and housing and hunger. That's a lot to try to cover. And I remind you, those of you who know about the website, and some of you don't know about the website, that on the website for these classes, which is www.dougdowd.org, you will find this chapter that all this is from. You'll also find the preface, the first chapter, and the epilogue. It's from a new book that is not yet published and may never be. And so what I'll be doing this evening and what I did last time is reading some part of what I'll be doing. I'll be reading from that book. But it's all on the website. It's chapter 3, and it's called Human and Social Needs, Greed and Guile versus Sanity and Decency, or something like that. And also, we decided that the last two meetings, which is to say in September of the class, we'll try to do what we can to talk about what we can do and how to do it in this San Francisco, California, or in the Bay Area, in terms of not just being angry and frustrated and so on, but looking for the things that we can do and doing them. So I want to talk about Social Security tonight. You all know a lot about all that already, but I'll just try to touch some of the highlights. But before I do that, I want to stick in something that belongs in this whole setting of human needs, human and social needs. And that is to say, economically, socioeconomically speaking, what has been happening in the last quarter of a century or so, to say nothing of what portends now, in just in a couple of words, so to speak, although it's laughable for me to say I'll ever do anything in a couple of words. But there was a nice little article by Paul Krugman about a week or so ago called Losing Our Country, in which he gave some data which they sound like nothing. It's really remarkable what kind of deterioration socioeconomically has been going on. When I say socioeconomically, I mean not just in terms of money, but health care and so on and so on and so on, education, the things we're talking about. It's remarkable how this country has degenerated, seriously degenerated in the past, since the 70s, and how little stirring there has been about it. Indeed, the worse it gets, the easier it gets for the right-wingers to become always more powerful. There's something really wrong with us that is so, with us as a people. And it's true also of the people like us in this room, people who know that this is so, who are very angry about it, who are terrified about it, perhaps disgusted, and so on. And we have not made the maximum effort we must make in order to slow this down, let alone to reverse it, let alone to start building something decent. And just let me give you a couple of indications of what's happened. This is a quote from Krugman's article in the Times. He's getting better all the time. Working families have seen little, if any, progress over the past 30 years. He's talking about working families, people who work. Adjusted for inflation, the income of the median family, half below and half above, doubled between 1947 and 1973. Between 1947 and 1973, the average real income, money income, doubled. Okay, that says nothing about health care, education. It talks about the money received, not what's going on in terms of social things. But between 1973 and 2003, the next 30 years, it rose only 22%. That is to say, a fifth as much as it went. And much of that gain was a result, this is for families now, was because wives entered the paid working force. And now two-thirds of all married women who are still married are working, and they have children. Okay, so to say that the income went up 22%, although the number of people working in the family has gone up 100%, is really something. Meanwhile, economic security, he says, is a thing of the past. Year-to-year fluctuations, the incomes of working families are much larger than they were a generation ago. All it takes is a bit of bad luck in employment and so on and so on and so on. But the wealthy have done very well indeed. Since 1973, in that same dark period for most people, the average income after inflation of the top 1% has doubled, and the income of the top 1/10 of 1% has tripled. Okay? Tripled. And it was already up in the sky someplace. And that's the income that they declare. Okay? And the richer you are, the less you declare. I've told you my brother was in the business of getting people out of having to declare the income they got. And he became a millionaire in the process. And so on, so on, so on. He goes on. And that's just one way of saying, hey, what's going on? But at the same time, what's also happened in this period in which we're told that the economy is in pretty good shape and so on and so on, is that in fact it's in increasingly worse shape. And when you read in the newspaper or hear the Bush administration say, well, but unemployment is stabilizing, or in fact it's being reduced from 5.2% to 5.1% or something, that's just plain bullshit. Because as I've told you so many times, those of you who have been in my classes or in everything I write, whenever I use the word jobs or employment, I always point out that the employment rate as the official employment rate, and the Labor Department admits this, the official employment rate is about 50% of what the actual unemployment is. If you mean by unemployment people who want a job and can't get it. Not if you mean, as the government means by unemployment, people who are known to be seeking jobs. Okay? Now, what happens over time, and this is what this article is about in the Times, is that people quite simply stop looking. And the worse it gets, the harder it is to get jobs, the more people who have been out of work stop looking for a job because what's the point of it? And they are not counted as unemployed. You understand? You're not counted as unemployed unless you are known to be, that is to say, unless a poll of some 30,000 people in the country shows that you are looking for a job. Secondly, you are counted as employed if you're a part-time worker, even though you were and need to be and want to be and seek to be a full-time worker. And a part-time worker is officially considered as employed if he or she works 1 hour a week. Okay? So the unemployment rate doesn't, to say nothing of how many people are working part-time and need to work, want to work, always did work full-time. To say nothing when we talk about those who do in fact have a full-time job, or people who were working in jobs where they were getting $15 or $16 or $25 an hour. An hour! And now they're working for $5 or $6 or $7 an hour doing not skilled work, but shit work. Because the whole manufacturing sector is just going down like a punctured balloon. Very slow leak, but it's going down. Every month, the data comes out from the Commerce Department. Every month, there is tens of thousands of jobs that are reduced in the manufacturing sector, and they will never come back. Now, those are just two kinds of data, that raw economic data. But at the same time, as I said just a moment ago, the cost of living, if by living you mean getting along with a kind of a decent, safe, dignified life, where if you're ill, you can get help, where if your kids go to school, they'll be going to a decent school, where if they earn the grades to go to college, they can go to college, but it's almost impossible now to go to college, unless you're from a rich family, or from a upper middle income family, which is really breaking its ass. To say, my son, for example, says he figures it'll cost him $180,000 to send his daughter to the university if it's going to be a decent university, and about half that if it isn't decent. Okay? And you can't get anything anymore unless you've been you're a college graduate. And it's just going down and down and down and down, the kind of people, and so on. And now it's harder to get the loans. The loans are more costly. They're just raising the interest rates on the loans for college. So it's just, et cetera. Okay? To say nothing of the kinds of things that I've talked about so much, we are in fact facing a set of crises which in no way can be interpreted to be hopeful, but in many ways can be interpreted to be really scary, economically, socially, militarily, environmentally. And we have a government of turkeys, drunken, vicious, brutal turkeys running everything. And the people... So let me talk now about Social Security and then try to get to something else. I don't think there's anyone in this room who's taken in for 1 minute by what Bush is trying to do about Social Security, nor do I think the nation is, except for a quarter, maybe 35, 40% of knuckleheads who don't know what the hell they're doing when they read about the ownership society that they're being invited to join, which will kill them off. But nevertheless, I think it's useful to... I don't teach these classes to try to change your minds. I teach the classes as trying to strengthen your minds, okay? Because I know you're all agree. We all agree about things anyway. But the thing is, if you're going to be political in an effective way, you have to be able to make strong arguments with people, okay? People on your side, but also people who should be on your side but aren't, because they're misinformed and disinformed about so much and haven't had the time or the inclination to get informed. And I want to start with Social Security this way, that in the first place, the very idea that the government should have anything at all to do with what happens to people when they are too old to work or too ill to work, the very idea in the 1930s was seen as mad, crazy, communistic, no sense at all. Milton Friedman, as you probably know, lives in San Francisco, and as I pointed out, He lives about two or three blocks from me. If I ever see that piece of shit, I'm going to stamp on him. I really do. He just lives right around two or three blocks from me. I know where he lives. I know where he lives. So if he gets shot or busted or anything like that, don't ever let anybody know that Doug Dowd said he knows where he lives, because it'll be blamed on me with some reason, because if I ever do see that piece of shit. This is what he said. He was in, this is from the San Francisco Chronicle. They discovered that he's here. And good reporting, you know. This is what he said in a recent interview in his home in San Francisco. "I've always been opposed to Social Security," he said. "I think it's a very unethical program." Can you imagine that? That's the reason I'm reading it to you. Unethical is another word for immoral program. It's just, of course, the opposite of the truth. It's just exactly the opposite of the truth. And that piece of shit has been getting along, sold as apple butter, ever since the 1960s when he began to write his... I can't get the word out of my mouth. The four-letter word, B-O-O-K, but it should be something else. And he has won. I read to you the first time we began to talk about the things he wanted to get rid of. Well, he was against it from the beginning. My brother was against it from the beginning. My brother was in the financial industry. And that's why he was against it. Because Social Security takes money away from what might also otherwise go into private insurance and into the stock market, bonds and so on. That you understand? Social Security, when the government gets into the act, it's competition for funds. It takes, if Bush gets his private accounts, think of what that would do for the stock market. All of a sudden, everything would be going up for a while, only for a while. Okay. So to have the perspective on this is that it's a miracle, not a miracle, it's an explicable big change in the way things happened in the 1930s because of the Depression, because the business community had lost its great prestige of the 20s and earlier, because they took all the credit for the 1920s great prosperity decade, which was not a prosperity decade. They didn't even measure unemployment then, but there are data. And if we use the understated measures of poverty in the United States, which we now have, which are just as bad as the measures for unemployment, half of the people in the United States were under that poverty level in the 1920s. So to say that business wants to take credit for the 1920s, okay, let them take credit for the 1920s with half of the people in that period, which is called prosperity decade. They want to take credit for it, want to take credit for it. But in the 1930s, things got to be so bad. I don't know how many of you were, let's say, teenagers in the 1930s, early teenagers, or early 30s. But it was so bad then. It's hard to remember how bad it was. So people, because it was so bad, I'm talking about not just the United States, but everywhere, but now I'm talking about the United States, people began to fight back. It was so it couldn't get any worse. If you were a worker in a steel plant or an auto plant or on the docks there in San Francisco, things were really awful. And it doesn't ever take a majority to make these changes. There was, in fact, a predictable, finally, in retrospect, a predictable minority. Here, there, and elsewhere, all over the country from 1933 on, there was one strike after another. All of them were really tough. Most of them ended up with beatings and deaths, okay? Almost all of them. And the deaths were not just workers on the docks or work. There were families who were out in front of the factories and so on and so forth. It was just hideous stuff, okay? Read Stud Sterkel's Hard Times. Read Stud Sterkel's anything. I love that man. So when they finally did begin to do the Social Security thing in the 30s, and it was, in fact, the very first step of the New Deal, what we call, the historians call, the Second New Deal. The first New Deal, which Roosevelt started in 33, was all pro-business. It started the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, which was really a right-wing, business-designed thing, which, when the Nazis sent a bunch of economists over to the United States, they wanted to study the NRA to get ideas from it for themselves. Okay, that's how bad it was. Roosevelt was not very good at all when he came in as president, but he wanted to get reelected, and he had some good advisors, not least Eleanor, who was really a great, great person, great woman, great person. And between her and some of his advisors, they made it clear to him that if he was going to get reelected in 1936, he'd better goddamn well get off his ass sometime before 1936. Because the election of 34, the congressional election, put a lot of people in Congress who were not ever supposed to be there, you understand? And the unions were going and so on and so on and so on, and there was a lot of organization going on the right and the left, Father Coughlin, you know, on the one hand, and what's his name, Upton Sinclair out here, and all this, so everything in between, Huey Long. So he began to listen, and Roosevelt was a very practical guy, and he was a very nice guy, finally, also. Really a nice guy. He couldn't help it if he was born rich and all that horseshit. He grew up. He became a mature person by the time he ended. And so, but the Social Security thing was the very first step, and it was quote, a revolutionary step. So it began wrong. It was such an extraordinarily wrong idea as far as the U.S., as far as Uncle Sam thought. Everybody, each for himself, God for all. You don't want to have any goddamn government doing anything for you. And if the government does anything, it's charity, it's welfare, it's pity, and so on. It's no sense at all that a society has to have some kinds of institutions that care for it and its people, rather than letting the people who are most aggressive in trying to make money for themselves when they succeed, letting some of that trickle down on the rest of us. Because that isn't the way it works. The way it works is you get the Fortune 500. That's the way it works. Okay? And they get the government. The governments, I should say, all of them. So when it started out, the sin of Social Security started out when it was born. It started out with a compromise, and the compromise was not that the government would pay for it, that people had a right, which they do in other countries, incidentally, that people had a right to be taken care of, to be kept alive decently when they couldn't work anymore. It was obligation. This is the need. This is not a fancy that people have, that they want to stay alive when they're old, or they want to stay comfortable, or they want to be able to be healthy. That's not a fancy. It's not like buying an automobile or a piece of candy. It's a need. It's a human need. The government. But that isn't the way they saw it. They saw it in terms of market things, okay? So they compromised, and the compromise was really a deadly one, and we're paying for it still. They decided that everyone who got Social Security would have to pay for it through payroll deductions. First place in the whole world that they did, and the last, that they did this. Payroll deductions. But it isn't just that. The payroll deductions were made so that everybody paid 1%, this is in 1935, up to $3,000 income. And nobody paid anything over $3,000 income. You understand? So if your income was $300,000, you paid 1% of $3,000. If it was $3 million, you paid 1% of $3,000, period. And that's the way it is now, except now it's 7 to 8% of $90,000. It just popped up again. And when you retire, you get proportionate to what you put in. So the poorer you were when you worked, the poorer you will be when you retire. That's justice. And most Americans would say, well, that's right, okay? After all, you put so much in, that's all you should get out. Adjusted for what happens in the bond market and so on, so on, so on. There's no sense of need. It's just no sense that what we should be doing when we're talking about Social Security is, how are people going to take care of themselves when they retire? And especially one has to ask this about, how about the people who have been working their asses off all their lives for very low wages? What are they going to do when they're not even getting that anymore? Well, they're going to get the peanuts they put in times two or three as half a century goes by. Well, so that's how it began. And that's where it is now. And all of a sudden, when I say all of a sudden, it isn't all of a sudden, but gradually, I should say, for the first time, I've been paying attention to this particular point for at least 40 years, okay, about Social Security. And a friend of mine wrote a book about it, who's in the Brookings Institution, incidentally. So I've been paying attention to this. And whenever anybody says there's something wrong with Social Security, nobody's ever said the thing that's wrong with it in the first place is that it shouldn't be done on contributions. It should be done in terms of need. Establish what the need is for people who have retired. Some people's needs are going to be set out, be paid for by this amount. So others, if you're rich, you don't need anything. You got it. If you're poor, you need a lot more because your health is more likely to be poor and your housing is more likely to be poor, et cetera, et cetera. But that isn't the way it worked. And that isn't the way they're working now. Now what they're trying to do with the privatization is to see that you don't get anything at all except insofar as you invested it wisely as though Mr. and Mrs. America know what to do in that respect. It's just savagely wrong. And it started off wrong. It started off wrong the same way that when the Clintons tried to put the health care thing in, they compromised from the beginning and said, they rule out the effective equivalent of what I was talking about for Social Security. We rule out need. We rule out the right of people to have health care because it's a human need. And we say, we will decide whether we will do that this, that, or the other way, all of it will be through private agencies, HMOs, business companies, and so on and so on. And so then we went from bad to worse, as I said last night. There's something so awful about this. It's almost indescribably awful. And it's getting worse. So let's look at the median family again in terms of payroll deductions. This is between 1977 and 1987. What happened just in that 10-year period? The median family in those 10 years, in that period, which was an inflationary period, incidentally, their family income rose about 75%. From $16,000 to $28,000. That was the median income for a family. But its income tax payments rose by 84%. And its Social Security payroll deduction rose by 116%. Understand? Their income went up less as a percentage than their deductions went up. And this says nothing about the fact that there was inflation going on. That was the period of so-called stagflation. Okay? Hard to get a job, and when you paid for something, the prices were going up. It was a very serious period of inflation. The after-tax income, because their after-tax income after all these things considered, declined by $2,000. But it declined because of the increase in the payroll deduction. In other words, what was supposed to provide for Social Security was being robbed. And this is something else that I have to say that nobody talks about today. You talk about the Social Security budget crisis and the lockbox and all this stuff and where the Social Security is going to run into this terrible crisis 10, 20 years from now. Social Security is going to run into that crisis because it's now part of the budget of the United States government. It wasn't ever part of the budget of the United States government until 1966. LBJ put it in as part of the budget, that is to say, raised by taxes, general taxes, and paid out in the same way. He put it in, instead of being it's something which went on to the budget, it was entirely financed by deductions, you understand? And it had the lockbox, its own investment. And it had enormous amounts of money in trust for itself. But as soon as it was put under the budget, two things happened. One, it became accessible to the government. to use. But the other thing that happened was that it became, into becoming part of the budget, the expenditures of the government in 1966 were $100 billion. Okay? And the taxes were $100 billion, so you're in balance. But then you put in the Social Security budget, and let's say that it adds another $10 billion to the income, the taxes. But it also means that the expenditures, and this is a subtle but very important point, it means, and this is what Johnson was concerned about, it means that military expenditures as a percentage of governmental expenditures have gone down because the expenditures have gone up, even though they haven't gone up. So Johnson did this as a way of disguising what was happening in the Vietnam War with respect to military expenditures, and it stayed that way ever since. So military expenditures as a percentage are always, since that time, understated. I mean, there's something so cheap about this, so dishonest, so clever. The private accounts. That if you talk about private accounts, what you're saying is that Social Security should be exposed to stock market fluctuations and bond market fluctuations. That is to say, should be exposed to the intermittent, or as now, continuing fragility and always rising fragility of the financial sector, which is really fragile. Always more. Always more because, in part, only in part, because they've managed to get rid of all the regulations that came up in the 1930s and subsequently to try to control this madness. One of the problems is that how are people who are doing this going to know what to do? Well, they're going to have to entrust, as they do with 401ks, they're going to have to entrust their private accounts to somebody, some expert, who's getting a percentage of whatever's going on, as it happens, and who's a professional financial person. And that private person who's doing this is a part of the financial structure, which is to say he's as dumb as a goat about almost everything except greed. That's one good. What's the one thing he's good at? Greed. If you can't understand what's going on, just read the financial pages every day. See what's going on every day. I mean, all these top guys, see what they've been doing. It isn't just that they're frauds and thieves. It's that they're stupid. Well, as it happens, there have been studies of two countries where they have private accounts now. One is Britain, and the other is Chile. And in both cases, okay, this has been going on now for some years. Chile, as you might know, is our stepson. And they become just like us in many, many ways. Some of them start struggling to try to get out of it now a bit. But after Pinochet, they are the most capitalist of all the Latin American countries, and always have been, I might say, but even more so now. Now they're capitalist in the sense that we are, which is to say, really iron rule kind of stuff. And the percentage that these people have lost through their private accounts is substantial, both in Britain, which had, of course, until Margaret Thatcher came along, it had kind of a left New Deal program in place for many, many years. But since the 70s, and Reagan really learned from Thatcher, and Bush and his pals really learned from Reagan. When I say Reagan, I mean as a symbol. So both the places that have had these private accounts have paid for it. That is to say, the people who had them, who have them, the ordinary people, have lost money. Would have had more if their Social Security, if they'd had a governmental program. And the same thing is going to be true here, except we aren't going to have the private accounts. But on the other hand, we're not going to do anything else that's sensible, which is to say, let's take Johnson, LBJ, one step further. Okay, pal, you want to make it part of the government's budget? Let's make it part of the government, okay? Let's cut out this horse payroll deductions, and you get back what you put in. You get back what you need.